The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This is an audio version of the 24th Annual Dice Awards Roundtable Series. To watch the video of this episode, please visit youtube.com/officialAIAS.
Brought to you by the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences. This is the award celebration by game makers for game makers, honoring the games that connect players around the globe. No matter where we come from or what our interests, video games bring us together. We gather here to honor our fellow creators and the very best of interactive entertainment. Welcome to the 24th Annual Dice Awards.
Welcome, everyone. Before I get into the introductions about our nominees, let's please get into what the category is. This is a conversation with the nominees for Outstanding Achievement in Art Direction. So we welcome all of you to the 24th Annual Dice Awards. And again, I'm Khalif Adams, and I'll be your host for this conversation. Before we get into it, let's talk about our nominees. First up, we have from Ghost of Tsushima, we have Jason Connell. How you doing, Jason?
Hey.
Give the folks at home a little bit of info about yourself, please.
Yeah, so I've been working at Sucker Punch for a little over 10 years, and predominantly my background before that was another 5 or 6 years in games doing shading and texturing, and then I did a fair amount of lighting and cinematography work with Sucker Punch, but moved into a lead role, and then on this project was my first project as art director, and also I shared the co-director spot with Nate Fox, and so this journey's been. I've been really fortunate, and Ghost has been such an awesome experience for me to be one of my first games putting out there as director. So it's been great.
Awesome, awesome. Thank you so much for being here. Representing from Hades, Gen Z. How you doing, Jen?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Doing okay. Doing all right. Not too bad. How's everything going? What have you been working on?
Oh, working on trying to take a breath after shipping Hades and preparing for the next thing, refilling the creative juices, right?
Yeah. You've been in the space for a minute, give the folks at home a little bit of info about, the breadth and depth of the work you've done over this.
Sure. I've been the art director at Supergiant Games for the last 10 to 11 years, I'd say. And Hades is actually the first one where we've had like a pretty expansive art team of 5. And so I feel like in this last game, we've really been able to flex our art muscles a bit harder. And it feels really good to create something a bit bigger, a bit stronger, and a bit more beautiful than the rest of what we've ever done.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being here and for rocking with us today. From The Last of Us 2, we have Eric Panglian. How are you doing, Eric?
Hi, pretty good. I've been at Naughty Dog for a while, probably like 24, 25 years, lost count. I started as an environment artist, and I became lead around PlayStation 2, maybe in the Jack days. And I became art director in the Uncharted 2. It was probably like 14, 15 years ago. I've been sharing the art director role with John Sweeney in The Last of Us. And so all these years, it's just been a refinement of our process and trying to dial in like how we can squeeze out, more power on the PlayStation and just making our games look better every year.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for being here and spending some time with us today. From the folks over at Marvel's Spider-Man Miles Morales, we have Gavin Goulden and Jason Hickey. How are you both doing today?
I'm also doing great.
I'm happy that you're both doing well. Gavin, give us a little bit of info about the work you've been doing in this space.
Sure. So similar to other people on the panel, I'm an art director at Insomniac. This is actually my first project that I've been an art director on. Previously, I was a character artist. I was a lead character artist on Marvel Spider-Man, Sunset Overdrive, and BioShock Infinite. and I've been making characters for about 20 years or so. So that's really been my focus on this project and trying to make the most memorable, good-looking characters on PS5.
Jason, what have you been up to? What have you been working on in the industry?
Similar to Gav, but I haven't actually... I've been with Sony for about 7 years. But I've only been at Somniac just under 5 years. This is my first credit as an art director on a project. So I'm really like sort of excited and kind of overwhelmed to be in this group because the games are so beautiful. So, you know, well done, everyone. But yeah, so I came from lead environment for like just basically environment art the whole way through. I've been doing it for more than I can remember, 15 years, something like that. And I've traveled around the world. I'm from Ireland.
That's brilliant. I'm happy you're here. I'm excited that you're rocking with us as well. And to round out our group from Ori and Will of the Wisps, we have Jeremy Gratton and Daniel Van Leeuwen. How are you both doing today? Jeremy, tell the folks at home a little bit of information about yourself as well.
Yeah, I'm doing well. I've been at Moon for about 5 years now. Like some of you, this was my first opportunity getting to do art direction. Before Moon, I was working at Blizzard Entertainment in their cinematics department. I was a lead cinematic artist there. So getting to come to Moon and art direct for Ori, it was an amazing experience and really enjoyed working with all of our really talented artists here. So it was a lot of fun and it's a huge honor to be here with all of you guys.
Daniel, what have you been working on in this space?
I'm from the Netherlands. I've been in the game industry for about 10 years now, most of it in the Netherlands itself. So I worked as an environment artist at Triumph Studios. I worked on the Age of Wonders series and a few new projects there. And I got contacted by Moon Studios about 5 years ago, and I joined 4 years ago. And I've kind of grown into the art lead role. So I joined as just an environment artist, but at the end of the project, I was the art lead working with Jeremy on the art direction for Ori. That was great.
Well, awesome. Thank you so much, all of you, for sharing some great information about the work you've been doing in this space. And I'm excited to talk about all the wonderful things you did with the games that you made. You know, being an art director is a very specific and very special title, especially for the studios that you've worked in. I'm curious to hear, you know, you all talk about, you know, the process and kind of discipline that it requires to kind of, you know, bring those crafts and bring those talents to the games that you've made. I'm going to start off with Jeremy on that. I'm kind of curious to hear, you know, your thoughts about, you know, especially because this is one of your kind of first, this is one of the games you've worked on amongst a bunch of the games you've worked over your career. You know, what are some of the tools and talents you've kind of brought to that space to make this very, very special game?
Well, I mean, working at Blizzard Cinematics, I was familiar with a lot of the different elements that would go into building cinematic sequences. Even though I hadn't worked on them myself, my background was more as a character artist. But I was familiar with the different processes. So getting to come into Moon and then work with all of the different departments on that, it was really great because I got to learn more about all of the different aspects, you know, with, you know, effects and animation and the tech pipeline and everything. So I think that I was able to bring a well-rounded skill set. But for me, for sure, like this first time going around, it was a lot of learning. And also on the production side, we had to work a lot with our producer on scheduling and so on. And that was something that I had never really been involved with before, but I really felt like by the end of the process, I came out like that much more well-rounded because of it.
Yeah, I'm also curious about, you know, once you have gotten to the level of art director, you're then, you know, tasked with, you know, being in charge of and managing a whole bunch of other artists in the space as well. I'm curious, Jen, what are your thoughts about, you know, what that process looks like? You talked about now kind of having a bigger team of five folks to be able to work in and manage in that way. You know, what are the conversations that are happening in between that? And what are some of the challenges that you're finding kind of, you know, working in that space now, you know, having to direct other people to do the work as well?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. It's actually a constant question in my mind as I go forward with practicing both managing and management skills, leadership skills alongside actual production art skills. So like I, you know, for the first three games we made, I was the only production, like 2D artist on the project. And we finally found an amazing environment artist to help out with Hades work. And the managerial process, when it comes to managing just one or two other people, can be really rewarding if you're working with really talented people. And thank goodness the people I work with are incredible. So, you know, it's not that they take zero management time. It might also be that I am just completely neglecting them as a manager. It's often hard to say whether I'm doing it right or doing it wrong. Yeah, it's a constant balance, and it's a struggle to decide whether I should spend my time leading or if I should spend more of my time doing production work. And that is a conversation that is ongoing throughout the entirety of our processes, because, you know, the leadership demands and the production demands kind of wax and wane over the course of the project, and especially for us, because we were in early access. So there was kind of this process where we were shipping the game multiple times throughout the year. So that pattern of like, okay, now it's time to have more conversations and have more communication about what we're trying to do and what our goals are as an art team, versus, okay, now we're just all heads in, like heads down, just draw, get your work done. So it's constant struggle. It's interesting. It's fun. Like I said, I work with a really incredible team. So the only real negative is my own self-doubt as far as whether I really should be art directing, right? Because, you know,
I think we all are having that balance in most of our jobs too, of trying to figure out like, am I... They gave me what? I get a check to do this, and what? I'm supposed to be the person? Okay, fine. We'll keep kind of moving it on and figuring that out. I'm happy to hear that you are also having those kinds of thoughts as well, because I think most folks in this room would probably say a little bit of the same too. Jason, I'm kind of curious about that from your perspective too, about, you know, you talked about kind of expanding the teams because of this particular project, you know, kind of working overseas with different crews. How different has it been to kind of, you know, cross collaborate, you know, with your kind of US based team and then some of the other folks who are overseas, and how that conversation might change for you as an art director as well?
Yeah, it certainly adds a crazy new challenge into the already challenging thing that we're all trying to, create this game that looks great and has a sense of style to it and all that. But, you know, I think that the very early on, for me at least, is just you have to kind of set yourself into a mindset of you have to enjoy the learning for the next few years, not just not your typical type of learning, like new tools or new lighting engines or, you know, that kind of stuff. That's always fun too. I love that stuff. But seriously, like learning about what your preconceived ideas about, you know, representing a culture might be right or wrong. And you have to be okay with the fact that you probably might've gotten it wrong. And that's why you hired people to help you make sure you get it right. And so you have to kind of thirst for that a little bit. And so, especially if you're going to work on a project for 4 or 5 years, you know, it's an incredibly long journey. You definitely get into spots sometimes where you absolutely want it to, you know, achieve a certain feeling or a certain way that it might represent itself visually. And then you come to find that maybe your research or one of your, you know, consultants that you've hired has expressed that that's not the way that it should go. And so you kind of go back to the drawing board on it. So there's a lot of iteration on that front and the creative side of it, the good composition that you wanted or the, you know, the colors and, you know, things that you wanted doesn't go away. So you're just trying to achieve both goals. Which makes the process fairly long. But one of our goals early on was also not to be just completely realistic. You know, we played around with, you know, photogrammetry and stuff like that. And in the end, it's just for us and for our game, we wanted a little bit softer background. And, you know, instead of, you know, representing a fir and forest with, you know, ferns and grass and weeds and trees that are dead and trees that are alive. We just said, how about we just do a, you know, dominant species of just ferns, you know, really, really bright, vibrant greens. So people remember the fern place. And actually that worked out really well. Our consultants ended up actually really liking that. Our colleagues in Japan, really liked that. The number one bit of feedback that I got early on that I really kind of latched onto and made me realize how much I cherished working with them, was that our first, first playable, you know, that we shared with our Japanese colleagues, we were like, the game is not green enough. It needs to be more green. And you know, then I looked back and I was like, oh yeah, it's just like, it doesn't have as much vibrancy as you'd imagine. And, you know, and therefore, you know, you look at the game now, it's incredibly lush and rich. And so I certainly thank them for that, but it's a big process. It's certainly a new challenge in the chapter of making games. But you know, couldn't have done it without that team. That's for sure.
Yeah. Eric, I'm curious to hear from you as well, because you're an industry vet, you've been doing this for over 20 years. You know, how has the process kind of looked for you now that you're kind of, you know, one of the folks that I'm sure folks in the team are looking to for guidance and for, you know, correction and for advice when it comes to that? And how has that kind of changed over the years that you've been doing the work in the art director space?
Oh, it's always changing. Because like there's always new elements, like new IP. We always try to reinvent ourselves. As you know, we came from a team that did Crash Bandicoot, right? And we evolved to Jak and Daxter. I mean, very similar stories with Insomniac, you know, our sister company. We had to grow our team based on our needs. And, you know, it was very difficult because, you know, we hire based on the game we're going to make. And as we got into the realistic or, you know, the realistic spaces, there's a different skill set that needs to be made. And as the games got bigger and bigger, you have to learn how to scale this without blowing your budget or hiring like 1,000 people, you know. So it's been a very exciting and challenging growth, you know, in terms of managing and trying to maintain the visual quality all throughout. You have to, you know, you can't do everything yourself anymore. You have to actually trust your team. You have to delegate. You have to create systems that can work for you and work smartly. So that has been the challenge of actually being the art director at Naughty Dog, because you have to create a leadership structure that you can trust, that can do the work and share, and you can just delegate it to them and trust that they can do the good job and getting the project shipped.
Yeah, I'm sure that, you know, a part of all of your jobs would be, you know, trust is a huge part of that conversation. I'm curious about, you know, not only how you build trust across your team in that way, but, you know, how do you continue to foster that when sometimes, you know, you're worried about, you know, a project not necessarily hitting what you wanted it to hit, or you're having those conversations within a team, you know, about like making sure that everything's kind of still cohesive across as many people as you're kind of working with in that space. I'm curious to hear that from you, Gavin, about, you know, how do you kind of continue to build trust and broaden that out across the rest of your teams?
I would say that a lot of it is communication, basically setting expectations with your team and always staying in touch with feedback and, you know, clearly stating like the status of like where a task might be, right? So on Miles, because I wasn't used to working with effects so much, that was kind of new territory for me. That's an example of where I would have to like rely on the leads because I didn't know as much, right? But it would be something that, you know, I'll be working with our partners or with design or with other teams to kind of figure out the requirements for what we need in game, and then setting the visual language and stuff. But as for how it actually happens, I would have no idea. I'd be the worst VFX artist imaginable. So that, like, that's something where I'm kind of in the situation where I need to trust people. And you know, the more that you stay in touch, the more that you review things together, the more that you can, you know, learn more about what they do and, you know, communicate like what your expectations are for their work. Yeah, I think just a lot of it is like staying in touch, especially now that we're all working from from home, having to replace that, walking by the desk and doing the hey buddy chat with Zoom meetings is something that we've kind of added to our lives for sure.
Yeah, those small little quick meetings and getting things done in that way is I'm hoping to get back to some of that because it just makes the process just move faster when it comes to a lot of those conversations for sure. Daniel, I'm kind of curious about, you know, when it comes to the art and animation within Ori and how well those parts kind of complement the game so well. It kind of combines this, you know, note of wonder, this exploration, you know, this ever present kind of layer of danger and kind of fear that's in the game that's kind of always around the corner. You know, how did you figure out ways to kind of, you know, make all that stuff work so well together? And you know, I'm sure it must have presented some challenges from an art perspective. You know, did you approach this in the same ways that you did when you started off with Blind Forest, or how did things kind of change in that respect?
Well, we were kind of in a unique situation because pretty much all of the team that worked on Will of the Wisp didn't work on Blind Forest. Mm. And there was a bit of overlap on the team. So we actually had a pretty fresh perspective on like, okay, what do we want to do with this IP? How do we want to take the game forward? And we brought these new perspectives. And then, yeah, we actually looked a lot at Blind Forest, like what are those guys doing? How do we keep the composition clean and nice? And we kind of wanted to continue on that branch, but upgrade the graphics. But one of the main points at Moon Studios is just iteration. Like we as artists, you basically have an empty canvas. You need to fill it with something. So you have something to look at, and then you can start tweaking. You can say, well, we're missing this, or we're missing that, or we have too much noise here. We need to simplify. Mm. And as the whole team just keep iterating like dozens of times on everything, and the story is constantly changing, the graphics are constantly changing, like the whole world is shifting around. In that process, like you just need to trust that everyone in the team, and especially the art director, has the vision for what the end result kind of needs to be, but that also grows as the project goes on. So it's just a lot of judgment from everyone in the team and working together to kind of shape that final look. And of course, also we made a bunch of trailers as we went. Usually those are good milestones to kind of get a feeling of what is this end result that we're trying to achieve and what is this feeling that we're giving to the viewer.
Yeah, it definitely did feel like, you know, there were moments when, there was a cohesiveness that came along with all of it, you know, and it seems like, you know, that transitional period of, you know, the two teams kind of, you know, getting a chance to do that handoff felt like that was very, very much in play there, which was really nice.
I guess it's also a bit of everyone in the team working on everything in the game. So it's not just that one particular person works on one environment, like it's just crisscrossing everything. Because people also, they kind of get blindsided on art if they work on it for too long. So it's kind of nice to get some variation in your work. And I think that also helps to just lift the whole game as a single piece.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. I think that pulls that into focus in a really good way. Jason, I'm curious as well, you know, I'm sure you had kind of similar challenges between, you know, Miles Morales and the previous game and kind of making sure that there's a cohesiveness to it while also kind of adding new things for the player to kind of find and new additive parts to what, you know, a very iconic New York would be in the game. You know, what were some of the challenges there of challenges and changes that wind up happening within, you know, the previous game to what we wind up seeing in Miles Morales?
I mean, it's a good question. Actually, if I sort of change it a bit, the real question that we asked ourselves was, how do we make this Miles Morales New York? That was where the whole stuff, we knew immediately, as soon as we knew we were working on the game, it was like, right, has to feel different to Pete, the city has to feel like it's his home. Yeah, the music, everything has to feel enough that we're giving this character who's an awesome character, relatively new in the Marvel universe, but still an amazing character with a lot of fans and support, and we love him as well. So it was being true to that. So we couldn't just be, well, is this a game where we're just changing the character model? No, it's not, right? So a huge amount of work went in from the animation team and all departments. When it came for the actual city itself, we went through some different phases of what we would do, but it was clear, like the most obvious thing to do was to make it winter. And this worked really well because I wanted to make it winter early on. But then when we were discussing it, the story, we were talking about it having it set over the holiday period. So it was sort of, the stars aligned and we were all on the same page, which was great. But it wasn't only just, winterizing New York. It was also about adding new content, taking old content that hadn't been, for whatever reason, it wasn't quite hit the vision that we wanted for the first game, or was new content. The other thing was we wanted it to feel like there's definitely a home for Miles, right? So there's a place where, although he's moving house, he's come from Brooklyn and he's moved to a new area, and he's struggling with that. His life has changed significantly, especially with the history of what happened in his family in Spider-Man 1. So we wanted to create a home, which was East Harlem, Spanish Harlem, El Barrio, whatever you want to call it. But in order to really capitalize on that, we wanted to make sure that there was the opposite of his home. So there was places that are alien to him, so you could feel slightly out of place while playing him the same way he would, which gave us the inspiration for working on the Roxxon faction, which is, for those who don't know, if you haven't played, it's very black with red, which had its own problems because Miles is his black suit with red. So, we were earlier on, we were like, oh, we should have picked a different faction. But so that, there's a really obvious juxtaposition between, the very glossy, highly technical, dark, cool colors, and then the kind of warm, familial colors for East Harlem. And we did that as well with the Underground and Tinkerer, with a different palette, and also with his uncle had his own palette that lay sort of halfway in between. At least that was the plan. So I hope some of it came across to the players. Sometimes I don't know if for everyone else where you're like, oh, this is great. And then you don't know if anyone even notices it. So,
I will raise my New Yorker flag and say you nailed it.
Yes.
I think, I will give you the New York nod to say, yes, you nailed Harlem in that way. And a lot of parts of the culture that go along with that for sure.
Yeah.
Jen, I'm kind of curious too about, you have a very specific, thing to tackle when it comes to Greek mythos, and making sure that you're kind of aligning that with people's expectations while giving your own interpretation and inspiration for it. Where did you all kind of come up with the inspiration for how you wanted the underworld of Hades to look?
Yeah, I think you actually kind of hit some of it on the head. One of our kind of creative pillars that we determined very early on in the project was we wanted to make sure that people could immediately understand what they were looking at, that at a glance, it would be obvious that this is about Greek myth. At the same time, we're Supergiant Games and we have a track record of doing really weird things. So we had just come off the game Pyre, which was its own esoteric, magical basketball game. And so it was really important to us actually for this game that we make sure to stay close to the source material, but not so close that we felt too creatively restricted. We wanted it instantly recognizable, but with a twist, like a fun twist. That being said, everything that we do on the art team at Supergiant, it's led first by the need to support establishing tone, establishing the narrative, and supporting the game design. And everything after that is really where the artist playground is. I mentioned Pyre kind of everything we do at Supergiant is this reaction to the thing we've done before it. On Pyre, we had told such a kind of somber story and tale. We knew we wanted to do something a little more playful. So that is where, you know, some of these characters have this more like creative and whimsical twist. So Cerberus, who is historically this monstrous hellhound, three-headed dog, right? Instead, in Hades, we reinterpreted him as Clifford the Big Red Dog. because we knew that we wanted to tell a story ultimately that was about this big dysfunctional family, and you have to have a big dysfunctional dog to be part of your big dysfunctional family. But generally speaking, it was important to me that we make this game immediately inviting. And that's true for, I think, every game at Supergiant. Like, no matter what we did, even if we joke about how internally, if we made like a horror game, we would find some way to make it beautiful. And it would be this weird, wacky thing, probably. Because that's kind of why I got into games. I loved the worlds that other people had built for me. And I wanted to go into them. And I want that same reaction for the players who are engaging with our products. So, did I answer your question?
No, you totally did. No, you totally did.
But yes, we reference the source material heavily. It's it was the first time we had this huge body of creative work that we could borrow from. And that was such a lubricant to our creative process. It was so refreshing. After having made three games where we had to really just like get down in the weeds about like, okay, well, what is this character and why are they there? And what is this world? And like, how come everyone can eat ham sandwiches here? Like, does ham exist in this world? You know, like that kind of thing. Like we were able to skip a lot of those conversations and kind of spend more of our time creating like around a very solid idea and having those creative constraints right up front, which was really, really nice from my perspective.
Yeah, and now I'm thinking like, well, would hell have ham in it? I would probably assume it would.
This hell definitely has ham in it. A ghost chef, and he needs ghost ham to make ghost ham sandwiches.
Well, that's a perfect segue to Eric to ask about ham in The Last of Us 2, which I'm not sure was a part of the design doc for any of that, but there was a real lean into around the kind of grimy and gritty aesthetic of the first game and how you were kind of be able to, you know, expand on, you know, building that out. But you're also really you know, did a really good job of finding beauty in two as well, which I thought was really profound. You know, how did you kind of enhance and build upon the kind of celebrated aesthetics of the previous game and kind of, you know, build on that for two?
Well, you know, like the original game was on the PlayStation 3. So PlayStation 4 gave us like very easy upgrades to make the game look better. There was already an established look, you know, on the original. So we just had to build upon what we have and make it be consistent. But one of the things we, you know, if I were to choose, like, you know, just to summarize it, the things we improve upon is the lighting. You know, we focused a lot on the lighting and environmental storytelling. We kind of wanted to refine those two elements in the sequel. Like, you know, our goal for the game was to create like the seamless cinematic experience, you know, that can be very natural and believable. So, you know, we rely heavily on natural lighting. So we referred to a lot of the films that we like, you know, that would immerse the players or the viewers and try to mimic them, like, you know, like The Revenant or Sicario, films that have great lighting and atmosphere and tone. And we try to replicate that. So the guys had to, try to squeeze out all these levels of subtlety in our lighting so that we can get a good value range. Being in Seattle, it was hard to light things because of overcast days and cloudy days. You know, like everything becomes very flat pretty easily. So we try to master that and how we can get directionality from subtle lighting these environments. Depending on natural lighting too, like nighttime became a problem if you didn't have a flashlight or a torch. So, and the way we handled it in this game, we just sort of embraced the darkness and like got more confident in just letting things go to black. The effect of that made the environment and characters integrate better and gave us better contrast all throughout the game. The next thing we wanted to improve was environment storytelling, which was pretty big on our previous game, but we wanted to tell the story a lot clearer. So, you know, like since Last of Us, we let you crawl now and like crouch to scavenge everywhere. We wanted to make sure that the fidelity of the game is consistent everywhere. But, you know, since we can do so much now, like what the other guys say, is like we actually found ourselves pulling back from detail and trying to simplify things because everything just gets so noisy and distracting everywhere. So, you know, we had to like simplify our palettes and homogenize our plants, you know, and, you know, instead of doing like 20 plants, we just like choose fewer and try to like paint it with that's a limited palette and control how things go crazy in the world. So most of my reviews is like delete, clean that up. And it was mostly about just getting the read better, you know, and you kind of want to curate the visual pacing as you go through the game. You know, you don't want everything to be awesome. You kind of want it to pace and build up to where you want the players to see, and then try to focus the players on the narratives and how they would present itself in the gameplay. So all of this have to be curated for the entire game. You know, every space we go to, we try to tell a quick story for the area. We look at real layouts and blueprints of spaces. So when we design places, they would be in the right proportion and the right room size. The flow would be correct. We try to incorporate that into the gameplay so that the place feels functional and authentic. And then when we try to prop things up, we try to make sure that it doesn't look generic and it doesn't look random. Everything has to have a purpose. Everything have to be functional. If it's a commercial space, we have an entire graphics team that like work on the logos, the marketing, the advertising, the purpose of their business, the slogans. You know, if it's a residential place, we put photos of people, you know, just to give that human element in there. Like, what are they into? What are their styles? You know, how do they make the place look settled? Yeah, and then on top of that, we put the element of age and time and damage and all the apocalyptic narratives. So it was pretty important that all of these layers are clearly communicated and be very clean so that the player, when they go through these spaces, they can understand exactly what happened.
That's brilliant. I mean, environmental storytelling is something that you definitely all nailed within the game and it presented a visual language for the player that was very important while going through the story, which I thought was pretty profound and fantastic. Jason, before we jump out of here, I wanted to poke you a little bit about Kurosawa mode on Ghost of Tsushima. You know, it was a pretty profound thing to jump into that for the first time and say, oh, wow, you really nailed this and went for it in a big way. Can you talk a little bit about the features that kind of made Kurosawa mode, you know, kind of further enhance the cinematic feel that Ghosts had?
Sure. It's one of my favorite parts of the visual journey that was creating this game. We knew that we were going to have a black and white mode from, yeah. I don't know, from almost as early as the conception of the idea of the game. But we didn't actually work on it until pretty late because, you know, rest of the game. And when it came down to time to doing it, we also were like, oh, what are we going to call this thing? And we really, you know, would love to have called it Kurosawa mode, but there's a whole process to doing that. And they wanted a sample. They wanted to see it. The estate for Akira Kurosawa wanted to actually see this. And this was like an, you know, opportunity of a lifetime for me. I was like, this is the dream come true, you know? So I put together a video and actually took in-game footage and did all the actual in-game correction and tried to study a bunch of the films that he had and the curves, the film curves, and tried to get the blacks to be appropriately right and the whites appropriate. And it was really tough, right? Because these movies, you know, they're fairly, you know, they're a movie, right? It's a linear sequence, right? So you know that it's, you know, it's outdoor. It's a this one shot indoor, and we're an open world game that you can go anywhere, and you can, you know, might be raining, it might be cloudy, so it took a ton of back and forth iteration on the black and white levels to try to get something that worked across our entire game. Sent them video. They took a little bit of time to kind of review it, and I thought they were going to say no, and then they agreed to let us use the name, and that's how it kind of ended up the name. There's also some actual audio profile kind of. Changes that we did to it as well to try to make it feel like an older film when you're in that space, cranking up the wind, things like this.
Yeah, that was brilliant. Jeremy, really quickly before we leave you all and talk about who won our award for today, in the game, do you feel like there was a very specific thing that, you know, from a kind of art direction standpoint that stood out? That was the thing that you're kind of the most proud of, you know, or do you feel like there was a thing that when you go back in that game, you feel like, here's the visual language that we just wanted to hit so that you can understand this kind of game, you know, that was the thing that kind of stood out for you all?
I think that we wanted to stay true to Blind Forest style. Like Daniel mentioned, it was a different team. And so we had a chance to kind of pick their brains a little bit and understand like why they made some of the artistic choices that they did, but at the same time, kind of stay true to ourselves, because we had a whole new team of artists that were coming in, and we all kind of have like our own artistic preferences and styles. And so it was kind of like striking that balance between the new and the old, and just finding ways to push the boundaries on the art. So one of the big things that we had on our list that we wanted to push, it's interesting because somebody else had mentioned this as well, was lighting. And so we really looked into the lighting system and what kind of things could we do with lighting in a 2D game, and not just static, but dynamic lighting. And huge credit to our tech team. They really came through for us on the pipeline. You know, a lot of times tech team might not get all the credit that they deserve for what goes into, you know, making the art for the game, but you know, we had kind of a vision for what we wanted to do, and they found a way to make it happen for us. And that was a huge part of how we were able to achieve the look that we did. And one of the goals was that we wanted, if you took a screenshot of Blind Forest and a screenshot of Will of the Wisps and put them side by side, that you can tell the difference. And I think that the lighting really comes through on that.
Yeah, that's awesome. I love hearing stories of that, because that's, lighting for me is a huge part of, you know, getting visuals across in a really beautiful way. So I'm happy to hear that was a big part of the effort there. I get to do my favorite part of the show now, which is give away an award. That's going to be super, super fun. Our DICE Award winner for the Outstanding Achievement in Art Direction goes to Ghost of Tsushima. Congratulations, congratulations, congrats. Congrats, Jason.
Thank you.
Give the folks at home a quick couple of thoughts about winning an award today.
Yeah, I mean, this is the most sort of the most intimidating one, right? Because you look across this board and it's like EP is basically a legend, and that, you know, so is Naughty Dog. You know, Spider-Man's animation is like some of the best I've ever seen in the world. And the art looks amazing in that game. The environment looks amazing. Ori just continues to be one of the best looking, you know, IPs. It's amazing. And then, hey, you know, Hades is, you know, made art direction wise by Jen, who's one of my favorite artists. So, you know, I'm looking this room and I'm just super honored to even be even in the room, let alone, you know, blown away by winning it. You know, working on this game has been one of the most prideful moments of my career. You know, I've learned a lot and I get to work with some of the most talented people at Sucker Punch and all of our new colleagues in Japan and all our consultants that helped us. You know, I too also value lighting. I did lighting for 10 years. It's one of my, I just think that it's getting the atmosphere and the lighting right in a game is so important. And I worked with our team to really nail this. And I just feel really fortunate to be at this point in the industry and that Ghost is enjoyed by so many people. So thank you for organizing this and super appreciate this award.
Well, again, thank you all for being here and for, again, you know, using your talents to make some of the most beautiful games on the planet. Jason, Jen, Eric, Gavin, Jason, Jeremy, and Daniel, thank you so much for being here with us. Again, hopefully we'll be able to get the chance to do this in person at some point. We'll see you all soon. Mm-hmm. And thank you again.
The Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences is excited to share that the 2022 DICE Summit and DICE Awards will be returning in person to the gorgeous Mandalay Bay Resort and Casino and Delano Hotel in Las Vegas on February 22nd to 24th, 2022. We'll be celebrating the 25th anniversary of the DICE Awards and bringing together industry leaders to share their ideas about the many facets of the interactive entertainment industry. Stay tuned to www.interactive.org and our Twitter, @official_AIAS for more details coming soon, including special anniversary rates. We can't wait to see you again.